Hi, welcome to Blogging Heads TV. You're watching Culturally Determined, and I'm your host, Arya Cohen-Wade. And my guest today is Alyssa Rosenberg. For most of her, she probably doesn't need an introduction, but I will ask her to introduce herself anyway.
Thank you so much for having me. I used to host a Blogging Heads show called Critic Proof, and so it's a delight to be back as a guest. I am the culture columnist for the opinion section of the Washington Post, and I think we're going to talk a lot of Game of Thrones today, so I'm excited.
Right, so we're going to be talking about Game of Thrones. And we are going to be massively spoiling everything involving Game of Thrones, the
Do we
show,
have to
which
say
just
spoiling?
ended
I
its.
hate the idea that, knowing about the plot inherently ruins the experience of consuming a work of art. We're just going to be,
Well, that's a, maybe that's an interesting point we can come back to a little bit later. But if for the purists who, maybe haven't caught up on their DVR
We will be discussing the fifth
yet.
season of Game of Thrones in detail.
Yes, and the books as well. Most likely. Okay, so you have been warned, all spoiler or spoiler purists. Okay, so first question I want to ask is Jon Snow actually dead?
I think it's unlikely that Jon Snow is actually dead. If you look at Kit Harington's interview with Entertainment Weekly, where he said, emphasized that he was dead, he was gone. He talked about being gone for season six, but not inherently for season seven. I think he's probably under contract. I think he is wording things carefully. And given sort of how overcovered the show is, he probably had to say something. But, I think Jon has either warged or will be resurrected by Melisandre, who showed up at a pretty convenient time and will have some
All
role
right.
to play in the final battle that's yet to come. So I'm optimistic that he's not dead.
Right. So in the books, so the season finale and the final the book that's been published so far both ended with the same or at least very similar scenes of Jon Snow being murdered seemingly by his fellow members of the Night's Watch. And in the book, it's kind of ambiguous. Whether or not he's dead, but seeing the videotape, it seems like they really do want him to be dead. And Kit Harington has gone on multiple, media outlets saying he's dead, he's dead, he's not coming back, he's dead. So, do you think they're just playing with us,
If they're playing with us, I wouldn't blame them. Game of Thrones has been, and I say this as someone who writes an enormous number of words every week about Game of Thrones when the show is airing, the show has been sort of picked to death in the press. And so that means because everyone is doing interviews after pivotal episodes, there are plenty of opportunities to present sort of disinformation about what's going on. And, if they're just straight up lying and he's back next season, or even if they're wording things carefully and he'll actually be back for season seven, I'm fine with it. It's a showrunner and an actor's prerogative to protect the integrity of the story. And so, maybe George R. R. Martin has sort of, hidden everything from all of us, and we've all been the subject of an elaborate misdirection. But I think John is probably coming back in some form or other. And so I suspect we'll see him later, and that people are just sort of managing this fairly carefully right now.
So much of the mythology and the mythology that the fans have pieced together about the show seems to hinge on him being a key character, and he was really kind of the last purely heroic character who's still alive. So it.
It's an interesting question, right? I mean, maybe this is some sort of dark, grim, indie Scandinavian drama, and anyone who has any drop of ambition or decency or hope for anything is going to be crushed under the hands of fate. But I suspect there's more to it than that. George R. R. Martin, when he was talking to David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, made them answer, who like they. He asked him about the sort of theory of John's parentage, and they gave him the R plus L equals J answer, which is, sort of suggests that John has something to do with the final. I mean, if that's the key to the show, then I think John's probably coming back. So.
Right. But the other thing I just thought of is that, this so R plus L equals J is this theory with the mythology of the show saying that, Jon Snow is not the bastard of Robert. He's really
Or n not
the
Ned, he's
sorry, Ned. He's
yeah.
the love child of Ned's sister Lyanna and Rhaegar Targaryen
Yes.
and for people who don't watch Game of Thrones, you could probably just check out now. But then this theory has been so widely speculated upon. I wonder if Martin maybe decided to change things up because this is a serialized, form of storytelling,
Maybe,
and
although I think
maybe.
he is, I mean, it's intricately plotted enough that I think he's known where the story is heading for a while. I mean, if Jon Snow is never a crucial part of the conclusion, which he's already discussed with Benioff and Weiss and HBO, despite the books not being finished, if Jon wasn't a critical part of the conclusion, then sure, maybe he's changed course. If he is a critical part of the conclusion, though, that conclusion has been set for a while, and so I don't know how much wiggle room there is there.
Right. Well, I for one hope he went into his wolf and maybe we get a talking wolf or something in season six. But yeah, it does I don't know. It seems like he probably is still gonna come back somehow or other.
That seems likely to me too, and there are a number of avenues to do it. I mean, he could just warg and be in Ghost, Bloodraven, the sort of Greenseer that Bran is studying with, apparently has the ability to bring people back. So maybe we'll see some of that. Melisandre could raise him from the dead, like Thoris Amir has been doing for Beric Dondarrion. So there are a lot of options. You know, whether Jon comes back or not, there's sort of a whole series of questions about how that could happen and what it would mean for the world.
Right. So one of the interesting things that happened in this season was there's always been this split between the fans of the show, of people who have read the books and people who haven't read the books. And the people who have read the books kind of know what's happened, going to come to pass. And maybe they lord it over their friends who haven't watched the books a little bit. And if I remember you did an episode after the Red Wedding, an episode of Critic Proof after the Red Wedding episode of Game of Thrones, and there was a weird phenomenon where people were using the phone the cameras on their phones to film their friends' reaction shots because they knew it was coming, and then they watched their friends, screaming and saying this can't be happening.
You know,
So there's this kind
Game
of
of Thrones has turned us all into sadists.
Well, we're maybe embracing the spirit of the show. So there's been this, yes, there's been a split, and we kind of knew what was going to happen. But this is the season where they really started changing kind of large plot points, and also continuing the storyline past where the books were. So we maybe the book readers got spoiled about what's going to happen, or maybe the show creators are going in kind of a different direction than Martin is going to go. So, I mean, what do you think about this new like breach in the fandom?
I've really enjoyed it, honestly. I've loved watching Game of Thrones. It's always exciting to see something that you've loved on the page get translated to the screen and see the edits that happen along the way. And for the record, I think Game of Thrones has given Martin's work a fairly tight, well-done edit across the board. You know, I would have there are quibbles here and there, but on the whole, I think they've done a pretty good job with it. But I'm ready to be surprised. It's fun to, you know, I have a lot of suspicions about whether these books will ever actually get finished. And so, in the absence of any guarantee that Martin's actually going to knock off the last two books or turn them into more books, I'm enjoying being surprised. I am enjoying being in new territory. And, you know, I think as someone who's read the books, it's still interesting to see how the long game is playing out differently or what it means to cut certain characters or certain plot lines. But I'm having a lot of fun with it. It's nice to be on the same page as everybody else and not to, you know, it lets me fully settle into and be attentive to the work rather than observing the reactions of people around me. And that's, I mean, it's a more fun way to watch.
Right, or being, knowing what's going to happen and trying to think like, is this going to happen here, or how are they going to do it here? I think it probably will be good for the fandom overall. So you think that maybe George Martin will not finish the series? You think that's maybe because of health reasons, or he just will get writer's block, or?
I think he's interested in other things. I mean, there is the Wild Card series. There's all this auxiliary material. He's been writing short stories that's set in some of the history of Game of Thrones. He's got a lot of other stuff going on, and I just, you know, he doesn't seem to be making an enormous amount of progress, and his attention seems to be elsewhere. And, you know, sometimes that happens. I also think when something becomes as sprawling and to a certain extent as much of a success as this has been, that can be sort of overwhelming. And so, you know, I would like to read his version of all of this someday. I would be curious to read it. But if he doesn't finish it, we'll get a great version of the story in the TV show. And so I won't feel like I have been betrayed in any way. Deprived, perhaps, but not necessarily betrayed.
Okay, that's an interesting point that I hadn't thought of before, that the TV series is definitely going to end.
Yes.
They say they're doing two more seasons, and George Martin, to the consternation of many of his fans, is taking a sweet time with finishing this series up.
Yeah.
And you would be more or less okay if all we get is the TV version.
Yeah, I mean, I want to know how it ends at this point. I've invested a lot of hours in my life, you know, wondering what this end game is going to be like. And so, to a certain extent, I'm just impatient, you know, and knowing that I'll know this time in 2017 is a little bit of a relief. You know, there are certainly storylines I'm curious about in the books and things that maybe Martin will do better, but I will survive. I'm a resilient person, and one of the great things about our TV environment is that there's so much wonderful stuff out there. I hope that Game of Thrones produces some strong imitators. You know, I'd love to see someone like Tamora Pierce, who's written a huge, sprawling fantasy world, actually, two of them. She's long overdue for a TV adaptation, and her stuff is basically The Wire with magic to a certain extent. So, and you know, knights and talking cats and awesome plots and, you know, sort of big world-spanning adventures. So, you know, Game of Thrones is going to end someday, and to a certain extent, I will be ready for the next thing by the time we get there, I think.
That's interesting. You know, I actually, it's funny you said the wire with magic, because I was thinking earlier this year that Game of Thrones is really the spiritual heir to the wire. It's not Tremé. It's, you know, the wire was about, one of the big themes was, you know, power in Baltimore and who has power and who is trying to get power and who is trying to use their influence to get things done. And Game of Thrones is, you know, power is one of the big themes, and people betray each other, and it's on a much larger scale, and there's beheadings and dragons and stuff. But I think some of the themes that were in The Wire are evident in Game of Thrones.
I mean, they certainly share a bleakness, that's for sure. There's, you know, these are both environments where, and I mean, I would say there are differences, right? I mean, Game of Thrones is not nearly as concerned with institutions as The Wire is. You do have something like the Faith Militant, but you don't necessarily see how people are operating in different parts of the same institution. You know, a lot of Game of Thrones is based on sort of individual choices. And individuals are much, much more important in Game of Thrones than they were in The Wire, even though I do think the shows potentially share a worldview about just how much institutions can, sorry, just how much individuals can do that is actually independent of or changes the course of institutions and or history, right? I mean, to a certain extent, you know, the Night's King is the Greek. He is, you know, he is a force of global something or other. The Greek is global capitalism. The Night's King is, you know, whatever the White Walker's agenda is. So there are these sort of unstoppable forces and individuals that stand in for unstoppable forces. But the shows do function in different ways, even though they share a certain amount of bleakness. And, you know, I think an interesting question for Game of Thrones may be how much it can sort of sustain its worldview, right? I mean, if Jon Snow comes back and he and Dany team up and burn the heck out of a bunch of White Walkers and the sort of heroic age is restored, how much will that invalidate what comes after, right? I mean, or sorry, what came before, right? I mean, if, you know, if Game of Thrones has been intellectually interesting because it has been a critique of sort of chivalry and chivalric storytelling, what happens if that order is restored at the end? What happens if we feel good about knights and princesses and dragons? Does that sort of invalidate all of the darkness that came before? One of the interesting strains of criticism of the show has been sort of its unrelenting darkness, but that was what people really liked about The Wire and found intellectually sophisticated about it. I mean, maybe it speaks to the strength of chivalric storytelling that we want there to be a good knight. We want there to be a wise, benevolent queen. We, you know, we want the little people to have a champion who is not corrupt. And, you know, maybe that is stronger than our belief in good cops? I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Right. Yeah, that's fascinating. And then any ending that Martin writes, someone is gonna end up on the Iron Throne, unless it, maybe there's some kind of, you know, Hobbesian state of nature
Unless,
that the dragons
unless the
and the White
dark.
Walkers bring in.
Yeah, I mean, my friend Sonny Bunch, who is the executive editor of the Washington Free Beacon and writes for me, sort of joked earlier that, you know, the only appropriate ending would be for the Night's King to end up sitting on the Iron Throne, right? I mean, that would be the dark fulfillment of Martin's worldview.
So
Whether
the Night's King is the leader of the White Walkers.
We don't know that much about White Walk. I mean, here I go being all pretentious. We don't know that much about White Walker society or organization or anything. So
Okay.
he's the creepy looking dude with what look like horns coming out of his head who animates people. So he is the White Walker that we has like a personality that we know about. So.
Right. And then, you know, you can imagine if Martin did want to go dark, you know, kind of a Walking Dead, you know, denouement of the show, where, you know, the zombies have taken over, and maybe zombies taking over, it would be the most intellectually honest and ending to how,
Or
you
merciful. I
know.
mean, life in the Seven Kingdoms seems pretty terrible.
That's true. That's true. But I mean, we do want to see the dragon battle, at least hopefully. And the CGI budget has gotten somewhat better in as the scenes have gone along,
I
so
mean,
maybe we will see a good battle.
all the White Walker stuff is still kind of stealing from Ray Harryhausen. And those scenes tend to do a lot less for me than they do for other people. But yeah, no, I would be interested in seeing a much bigger Drogon just like chomp the heck out of the Night's King. That would be fun. I would enjoy that, even if it would sort of intellectually destroy the show for me.
So you mentioned how dark the show is,
Yeah.
and this finale certainly kept with that theme. I was wondering if you thought maybe it's just getting gratuitous at this point. The murder of Myrcella, which, as far as I know, does not happen in the books. Maybe it's coming up in the books. I thought was, you know, just an extra gratuitous, you know, slam, and you have this seemingly nice character who reconciles with her incestuous with the father, who is she's the product of
Yeah.
incest, and then 10 seconds later she's dead by poisoning. I mean, did you think it's just going too far? Jesse David Fox on Vulture wrote a piece about this. Is, you know, is it just become like a tick at this point, and they just need to shock the audience with these, you know, instances of savagery and killing characters off, or do you think this is keeping with the spirit of the show from the beginning?
So it's an interesting question, right? People have been throwing around the word gratuitous with Game of Thrones a lot, frequently in reference to sexual violence. And I think gratuitous has come, unfortunately, to be sort of a critical stand-in for something that I don't want to watch or something that I find unpleasant. When, you know, something is gratuitous if it's unnecessary, right? And so, you know, I think that's a distinction that's really important to preserve. It's something I wrote about earlier this season. And so, you know, the question is, are these deaths, are these sexual assaults in keeping with the show's sort of worldview? Are they in keeping with the show's intellectual concerns? And that, I think, is a more useful question than, is this unpleasant to watch, right? Of course it's unpleasant to watch. This is a show about an incredibly unpleasant environment. And whether or not, you know, you think that world is historically accurate is a totally different question, right? I mean, this is not actually a documentary about the Middle Ages, but it is about a world where things are extremely unpleasant. And, you know, so I think reframing things a little bit is different. I mean, I don't blame anyone who's decided that Game of Thrones is no longer their cup of tea and no longer the way they want to spend 10 weeks a year. It is, you know, it is sort of it is an unpleasant place to spend your time, and not in a this is poorly done or, you know, this is, you know, sloppily executed. It's an unpleasant world to spend time in. It feels really terrible. I don't. know that I think that that's unintentional, though, right? I mean, I think this is a story about sort of a grind. It's about what a grind it is to be human and to try to find something decent. And I've always felt that way about it pretty much from the beginning. And, you know, if you didn't feel that way, if you were there because there were dragons and Tyrion was really funny, I totally get why someone would be done. But if you come to it as this sort of like grim, and people, you know, it's not just that it's dystopian necessarily, right? I mean, there are plenty of dystopias that have sort of love stories and like heroic things happening. It's a grim view of the world. And that's always been sort of appealing and interesting to me. I mean, and I think also think it's worth acknowledging, you know, someone crunched the numbers on how many sexual assaults there were in the show versus the books, and there are many fewer. They just happen to characters that we know better, and so we feel the emotional impact of them more. There
There are
is
fewer on the show than in the books.
many fewer by like a couple degrees of magnitude. There is incredibly brutal violence that's been edited out of the book. I mean, literally, there's a sequence where Brienne of Tarth like gets half her face eaten off by like a psychotic guy with his teeth filed down to points. Like, it's super unpleasant. That is a point at which I was not super excited to continue reading the books. And so, you know, there is stuff in the books that just seems gross to me, that just seems, you know, that made me feel like I sort of got the point already. You know, I can sort of see how a lot of the unpleasant things this season fit into larger themes, right? I mean, Sansa Stark is someone who was brought up her entire life to be accommodating, particularly to men, to be sort of a good wife in a certain way. She has twice before sort of avoided terrible things happening to her, right? I mean, Joffrey got murdered before he could start using her as a concubine after his wedding. Tyrion was kind enough not to force her to have sex with him. And so we're finally seeing what happens when that sort of streak of luck runs out, frankly. It's interesting to see her as a character and a person. This is her, you know, this is Sansa's story is about coming to understand that what you've been taught about your role as a woman, about what your husband's role as a man is, what arranged marriage is, she is coming to learn that all of this is a lie, right? I mean, this is a contained story arc for me. It makes sense. I understand it. I don't find it pleasant to watch, but I think it's an arc that has intellectual integrity and that has a clear progression to it. You know, similarly with Myrcella's death, Myrcella, frankly, has been a nothing character in the show for a long time. She got shipped off to Dorne a couple seasons ago. We haven't seen much of her since. That doesn't make her, you know, disposable as like a human being in the world of the show, of course. But again, we've had a multi-season arc that's about Jaime Lannister, you know, becoming something other than a fighter, right? I mean, he loses his hand. He, you know, has to start thinking of himself a different way. He forges this really warm, sort of open relationship with Brienne of Tarth that's not like something he's ever had before. And he finally has this amazing cathartic moment when, you know, he is recognized as a father by one of his children and loved by one of his children. And he loses that. And, you know, I totally understand if you're burned out on female characters being abused or hurt or killed for the progression of male characters. But I do think that Jamie's progression here, again, has intellectual coherence, has an arc, has consequences. And so, you know, I'm not saying it's fun to watch. If I were not a critic, I don't know that I would be hanging out in Westeros. But Game of Thrones is just a thematically fantastic show to write about, and it gives me tons of fodder. And I don't, you know, I don't find it hackneyed. I don't find it, I don't know, contrived. And so for me, a lot of the stuff we've witnessed has been super unfun to watch, but it has not necessarily been gratuitous. That said, as someone who is super, super freaked out, like has a deep and profound phobia about eye damage, Arya's going to town on Meryn Trant was basically unwatchable. There was some cowering, and I had to tell my fiance that, like, let me know when I can look up. I cannot do this. So that for me was like over my personal squick line, but you know, all of us have our own.
Right. So I want to talk a little bit more about Sansa's rape by Ramsay Bolton.
Sure.
And why? So it seems strange to me that this plot point kind of blew up and caused a United States senator to say she was stopping
Yeah.
watching the show, Claire McCaskill.
Yeah.
From the very, like, as we've been discussing, from the very beginning, the show has been, brutal and showing the worst things that people can do to each other. In the first episode of the first season, someone gets beheaded,
Well, yeah.
a child is thrown from a window, and I can't remember if it's actually the first episode, but there is an instance of, marital rape with Daenerys and Khal
Yeah.
Drogo. So, I mean, why do you think that this plot point kind of blew up and had people saying, "I'm quitting the show," and made kind of its own weird cultural moment?
Look, there's a lot of rape on television, and I think a lot of people's personal thresholds have been crossed. And again, I understand that. Again, I don't think that that scene was necessarily irresponsible. I actually thought it was shot in a fairly responsible way.
I agree.
But I do get that, for some people, it was too much. I don't necessarily think an analysis that this was something new for the show or that this is sort of out of keeping with the show's themes. I don't think you can make a particularly strong case for that, frankly. I mean, Roberts, if you're steeped in the mythology of the show at all, and this is stuff that you can get from the show as well as from the books, Robert Baratheon starts a war because he tells himself that his fiance is being raped by Rhaegar Targaryen. He employs the Mountain, who is, a rapist as well as just a brutal killer. Sexual violence is part of the sort of bedrock mythology of the events of the series, both the sort of the world that Martin has created and then the stories that the characters tell themselves about, what's righteous, why they're doing various things. And so, I think this is a moment that a lot of people have been dreading, right? Sansa feels like she's been spared on previous occasions. It speaks, I think, really well to the work that Sophie Turner has done as an actress and that the show's writers have done for, in giving her material that people felt as emotionally attached to her as they were. And so I understand why people just didn't want to see that. I have a harder time with the argument that it introduces a new level of brutality to the show or that it's not intellectually in keeping with the show's concerns.
Right. Do you think it might have something to do with the place that rape has assumed in the cultural, national, cultural and political conversation,
Yeah.
which seems to be a lot more than when the show premiered?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent there's that. I mean, I think, look, culturally, rape is used sloppily a lot of times. It is often a sloppy device. I think True Detective, which, spent its first season using the ritualistic murders of young women, it basically is an excuse for its two male main characters to like hang out and talk about the nature of the universes. That's an example of that. And so, again, I do think people are sort of sensitized and the discussion has moved in different directions. It's interesting to me. I do feel like we're sort of getting to a place where, that where we've been before in cultural criticism, where people sort of feel like depiction is endorsement. And I don't think, I think people are not necessarily, people see an act happening or know an act is happening in culture and don't necessarily read the shot or the framing of the shot or the way the dialogue is written. There are certain issues that if they come onto the screen just sort of override the other critical tools that we would use to assess a different scene. And so, I understand if people have sort of reached their personal thresholds or they don't want to watch certain things happen. But I don't know that that's not the same thing as definitive proof that a scene is careless or ill-intentioned or not thoughtful.
Well, why don't we talk about another really striking scene from
Sure.
the finale, which was Cersei's walk of shame, if we want to call it that.
Yeah.
What did you think of that? That's a huge part of the books,
Yeah.
and it's very, very arresting in the books, and it's How did you feel seeing it in the flesh?
I mean, again, it was really unpleasant. I thought it was spectacularly well done. And, one thing that's important to remember about that scene is that it's a technical feat as well. Lena Headey was fairly pregnant when that part of the episode was shot. And so,
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
yes. And so they were working with a body double. So that's, there's sort of a technical feat is like getting her head onto the body in those scene, the in those scenes. And so, there. It's very impressive work by both her and her body double, and then, the editors who put them together into a single performance. I think it's really striking, and it's a really powerful statement of the show's themes. The way that sort of misogyny comes out, especially, in difficult economic conditions. It's like it's a go-to. People are shaming Cersei not for being a bad queen, not for the way she's managed her children, not for, any of the decisions that have happened since her father's death. They're calling her a whore. That is the way that people express hatred of women is sexually. And they, it is, it always sort of comes back to gender. I thought it was really beautifully shot. Often in a way, it's a, for something that, something is very humiliating is happening to the character, but I felt like they did good work of not having the camera humiliate her. There are some full frontal nude shots that sort of emphasize how, that emphasize the sort of intimacy and the extent to which she has no protection. But a lot of the time she's shot from the shoulders up. We see things from her perspective to a certain extent. So I thought that was sort of an impressive bit of cinematography. For a show that's used nudity sort of as a window dressing, I mean, there are a lot of naked ladies and a lot of brothels. And I'm sort of, hey, I was impressed that in Bravos we finally get a brothel where, the women who are working there get to keep their clothes on at least some of the time. But, this is a
Yeah, I
bit.
think some critic came up with the term, I think, sex position, which
Yes.
was, they decided they need to get some piece of plot moving along, but to
Ha
spice it up, they have it
yeah.
taking place in a whorehouse or have the
Absolutely.
characters having sex while they're discussing this.
But this is, I mean, this is a very different use of nudity by, characters who aren't named, right? You see people, you see men exposing themselves to Cersei and telling her to do degrading things. You show, there's a woman who, again, exposes herself and sort of mocks Cersei for her nakedness. And so it's very different use of nudity than we've seen from the show in the past. It's assaultive to her, to us. It's not, and it's front and center. It is the point. It's one of the very few times that we have actually seen male genitalia on any cable series at all. And so that's, that's striking too. And so I thought it was much more sophisticated than what we've seen from the show in the past. And it's tremendously emotionally affecting, It's one of those moments where if, if misogyny is sort of a universal way that people express hatred at women, no matter what they're angry about, the woman in question, like no matter why they're angry with the woman in question, Cersei's experience and that way that scene is staged also sort of provide a powerful reminder to us that no matter how much we've come to hate a character, and Cersei's a fictional person, she's not a real woman, and so it's easier to sort of hate her and not feel like it means anything. Like, no woman should have to go through that, right? Like, she has committed incest. She has murdered her husband. She has made catastrophic decisions. She has enabled the very, the rise of the very fundamentalist organization that's now persecuting her, and she still doesn't deserve what is coming to her. And I think that's really powerful.
So Martin does something interesting in the books where they're all told from first person perspectives, and in the first book it's pretty much mainly the heroic characters or the good guys who their perspectives are told from, and then as the series goes on you start getting some of the less heroic characters and characters who you would have originally thought were total villains get their perspectives, and they become sympathetic. So this is what happens with Jaime, and also what happens with Tyrion. Sorry, Tyrion, and also with Theon.
Well, although I would say, I mean, Tyrion's one of the things that the show cut from the books that I'm actually really grateful not to have to read is hundreds of pages of Tyrion drinking himself to death and fantasizing about raping and murdering his sister. As well as the sort of degrading relationship he's put into with another woman with dwarfism that, is
Right.
really just sort of painful to watch. And so, the point of view characters can complicate the, sorry, the point of view chapters can complicate our perspectives of the people we think of as heroic as well. I mean, I thought much less of Tyrion after listening to him fall into his own sort of misogynistic rut for literally hundreds of pages. It's not fun to read.
Right, that's an interesting point. But Cersei gets her own chapters, I believe, starting in book four, and she does not become more sympathetic, at least for this reader. And then this awful, she's paraded through this awful endurance test. Do you think in the book did this make you more sympathetic to her, and do you think it's going to change how the viewers
Well, Cersei's
take
an
her?
interesting character, right? I mean, she is neither she nor Jaime have a lot of self-awareness, which to a certain extent is what lets them get away with their long-running incestuous relationship, right? Like they really sat down and thought a lot about what they were doing or what the repercussions could be. Things might not have gotten so far. And so I agree that the book chapters don't necessarily make Cersei much more sympathetic. I think the show sort of sowed the seeds of that from the beginning this season. It does, the show gave us the only flashback we've seen so far to Cersei and a friend going to essentially have their fortunes told. And we the season starts with a flashback to that, and then we see Cersei's anxiety about Margaery Tyrell. And so, by giving her a little bit of sort of psychological grounding, a little bit of history, I think the show did some work that to a certain extent is echoed in the books. And I think it helps. Lena Headey is a great actress. She is one of many people who's just really blossomed in this show. And I think she has done a lot of work to make us understand Cersei, even sometimes when it's not always on the page in Martin's books or, even sometimes even in the lines that she's been given to read.
Right. I want to ask you about one more character who
Sure.
came to his end in this final episode, although maybe he did not. So that would be Stannis.
Yes.
And only on reflection did I realize we don't actually see Stannis dying.
Yep, you don't. And Game of Thrones is really good at using cuts. I'm actually writing a piece about the whole season, and its signature editing move is the cut that reveals something to you before you've even, before anyone's sort of spoken aloud to tell you what's happening, right? I mean, the cut from Roose Bolton telling Ramsay that he's going to be getting married to Peter and Sansa on their horses. I mean, I just freaked out when that happened. There's like a lot of me slamming my keyboard in my notes. And so the cut is sort of their signature move. And so, I don't know that Stannis is dead, but what a great character arc this season. I mean, Stephen Delane has just done masterful acting work here. And, again, the burning of Shireen in the second to last episode, very controversial. Another instance of violence against women, another instance of something just being too much, which, again, I sympathize with. This stuff is not fun. But you have this beautifully written arc this season where, Stannis has rejected the idea of sacrificing his daughter before. And at the wall, we see them grow closer. But throughout the season, we also see Stannis' circumstances get much more desperate. And, Stannis, we have to remember, is a convert. His wife is the first person to sort of get converted to Melisandre's preaching. She ends up bringing him along. Stannis is initially sort of more suspicious, but he ultimately commits, right? And he does great damage because of his belief and because he's sort of set himself on this course. He has started an incredibly bloody war. He's been a kinslayer before. He killed his own brother. He has betrayed his wife. He's having sex with someone who's not her to create shadow babies to kill people. He has started this incredibly destructive. But he started this destructive war. He has sort of fundamentally changed the nature of the Night's Watch. And, if he declines to burn Shireen, he's saying that he doesn't believe Melisandre, right? He is saying, and if he doesn't believe Melisandre in this, then he doesn't believe her in anything. And so not burning her risks just sort of shattering his faith and forcing him to reckon with the thousands of people who are dead because of decisions that he's made. And so, I really appreciated that we got that just despair and disillusionment in this final episode. Iglesias, unlike me, is a parent, so I will leave, I will defer utilitarian questions of child sacrifice up to him. I think, you know, I think more than the question of the actual calculation is sort of Stannis' psychological profile and the nature of belief and the idea of sort of abandoning that belief and what it would mean. And look, I think it's completely fitting that Stannis experiences this completely catastrophic loss, that he is forced, that he is ultimately forced to reckon the nature with the nature of what he's believed and what he's done in the name of that belief, up to, you know, up to and including killing his daughter, prompting his wife to commit suicide. I mean, Stannis gets everything that's coming to him. And whether or not Brienne kills him, you know, in a way, leaving him alive to deal with all of that might be much worse than death by a, you know, single convenient stroke of the sword.